Hello again, and welcome everyone to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, a systems foresight series provided by ShoshimWorks and evolved from our collaboration with NASA's Convergent Aeronautic Solutions Project. In an era of exponential change, transformation is not just about adopting new technologies, as we'll discuss today, but is really more about fundamentally reimagining how systems operate within larger systems. Today, we're going to be exploring three decades of transformational leadership across defense, government, and Fortune 500 companies to reveal some universal principles for how we can build adaptive, resilient organizations from the Department of Defense to the emerging space economy. I'm Diane Finkhausen, CEO of ShoshimWorks, and I'm joined today by Faisal Hoke, founder of Shadoka, a best-selling author of 10 books, including Transcend and the forthcoming Reimagining Government, and a transformation partner for organizations such as the U.S. Department of Defense and CASI. Faisal, let's start with your journey. If you can, maybe just share with our listeners a little bit about your background and your work.
Thank you for having me, and I've been looking forward to this. You know, I had a fortunate and interesting career over the last 25, 30 years now. Started my career in Pitney Bowes as a engineer in an R&D group, and then went to Dun & Bradstreet. And right after that, started my first startup, which was in a middleware software business. And we were focused on financial industry like Chase and those type of customer. That then got folded in GE, launched GE's first B2B e-commerce when the internet was just coming out. Worked for GE a few years and then started my next company, which was funded by Gartner, Infosys, and a whole host of other people. That was in the space of software component. And then I got fired from that company by my own venture capitalist because they thought they could scale it faster than I could. Turns out that they were not quite so right, and it went bust after me being ousted 18 months after I got ousted. And after that, you know, I wrote a book called E-Enterprise. That was my first book, which got published by Cambridge University Press. And my argument was that the technology stuff is great, but it's if you really don't focus on the business model and the people and the foundational architecture, then things doesn't work. And that some fluke became very popular in academia. And since then, I built up a company, exited out of that company, and then last 10 years or so, I've been running a company called Shadoka, and then recently launched a company called Next Chapter, which focus on primarily nonprofit for cancer research by creating content. And along the way, I worked with some of the brands that you mentioned. My last 8 years of lots of work in public sector, primarily in DoD, which I wanted, you know, it started as a passion because I wanted to give back to our country by working with the government agency. So I got that opportunity by teaming up with my partner called CSEI, which is a Fortune 500 company now. So it's been quite the journey, and along the way I keep learning and I keep writing and keep making mistakes and highlight my mistakes, what works and what doesn't work. But I'm primarily a technologist who loves management science and apply management science, and because of my Eastern philosophical background and passion for it, I kind of try to weave that element of it in whatever I do.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Man, your journey has been amazing. And I love that you were early on really focusing in on the business model as the heart of the kind of the growth engine. And we'll be spending a lot of time on that today. And maybe if we could start with one of your books, starting with maybe Transcend. You topped a number of the bestseller lists. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And you have, excited to talk about your forthcoming book as well, but
sure.
If we maybe dig into Transcend just for a couple of minutes, this is really, I think, very topical for our listening audience. You talk about the framework for sustainable innovation and growth, and we focus a lot on resilience, right? How operating models can be designed for greater resilience in very dynamic markets. From your perspective, in all of your work, what are some of the fundamental shifts that you think, and that for leaders in their thinking, what kinds of fundamental shifts in thinking are leaders going to need to make in order to move from incremental improvement and kind of intense productivity focus to a more ecosystemic kind of resilient transformation kind of mindset, if you will?
Yeah, look, I mean, the Transcend, you know, me and my team started doing research and started writing about it, about 3 years ago. And you know, and these were kind of like at the height of the progression with artificial intelligence, of generational change in workforce and fundamental shift in what leadership means and doesn't mean, and the future of work, right? So all of those, and then we're all obviously very well aware of all the geopolitical changes that are happening, right? So in that context, the notion of collaboration, notion of governance, and notion of ecosystem is getting redefined, because along with human element, now you also have, you know, this synthetic or artificial force that we are dealing with, right? Whether that's agentic AI or whether that's some other things that are coming to the pipeline, it doesn't matter. So the role of leadership is much more complex than it ever was, because you kind of have to maintain this humanistic and human value system while leveraging these digital workforce that are emerging. And it's not like the early days of digital transformation that you and I are very familiar with, where we would take something and automate and we kind of use that as a tool. It's becoming much more active than passive technology, right? So in that context, I think that driven by purpose and human value and adaptive decision making and cross functional adoption. And then especially if you talk about agencies like DoD or NASA or any of those organizations, which is it has to be tied to national security, but it also has to be tied to the global collaboration. So it gets very complicated in terms of leadership thinking and leadership execution. So in two words, I think I can, you know, you have to, the new generation leaders has to be systemic thinkers, but also deeply emotional and intelligence driven. If I can just summarize what the next generation, one without the other, it really doesn't work.
So right. And we see for the folks that are focused on ecosystemic models and managing a more collaborative and networked model, it's that mission-driven work, right? And alignment, yeah. and purpose-driven work that tends to be kind of the center of gravity, that, you know, the shared value or the shared vision that brings the ecosystems and the clusters together and becomes incredibly important, but also, to your point, very dynamic and complex to manage.
Yeah.
Right. So in that, to your point, these advanced technologies are creating greater velocity in these systems, which makes the human element very fragile and,
yes,
and very important. So if we think about, you've done a lot of work on helping organizations transition to these networked ecosystem models. Mm-hmm. And for our audience, whether, you know, they're in aerospace, which we'll come back to the space economy, because it's just a brilliant opportunity to kind of apply some of these principles kind of white page. But for our audience who are, in many cases, managing complex missions with many diverse stakeholders, right? Shifting from traditional models to more networked and ecosystemic models. How does this transition really take or materialize in practice? How do you help them step through the transition? And what are some of the early indicators from your perspective that an organization is successfully making that shift from an kind of a hierarchical control to a more ecosystemic orchestration? What are some of those markers?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's often people say that an ecosystemic organization starts with a clear purpose and clear definition of outcome and transparency, how that purpose gets executed to create that outcome, right? But the saying is a lot easier than actually doing it, right? As we both know so well, especially in large organizations. So often what I end up doing is that I try to create a enterprise level portfolio structure that actually drives the bottom up, not just top down idea generation and execution model that brings in not just internal people, but also the external resources that you will require to do those execution. So, and, you know, the purpose, maybe the definition of the portfolio of opportunities that an organization should be driving towards. But the bottom up approach is where the team is actually coming up with the kernel of execution ideas that will support that. And you kind of create a federated governance model, but very much policy driven, right? So, I mean, you know, you kind of, you know, and it's very hard to execute, but I mean, you know, if you look at, you know, a complex ecosystem, organizational structure like NATO, as an example, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there is that very much of a federated governance model and various countries and various leaders weaves in and out and takes different role as time, you know, based on initiative and the priorities and whatnot. So I believe in this fundamental notion of not just talk about transparency and, you know, the purpose and stakeholders buy in, but actually enabling it with that enterprise portfolio structure that creates that traceability of transparency and creates a top-down, bottom-down collaboration that can expand beyond your four walls with proper guardrails, right? So that's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah, great points. Great points. We saw a lot of that in practice. I know you and I have a shared history at GE.
Yeah.
We saw a lot of that beginning to reshape GE's journey in their digital transformation, where, you know, the teams were engaged for ideation and to kind of percolate up what they saw kind of in the field and in their customer relationships, the priorities in the market as the markets were evolving. And then, you know, that informed policies and priorities. How do you, in your experience, how do you evolve, say, incentive systems and measurement systems, metrics, success metrics, as the organization is making that journey so that the behaviors are matched with the appropriate kind of compensation and reward systems?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's despite the fact that there is a downward trend in terms of, you know, the employment because of technology and other factors, the good people are always busy, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very important how you retain those good people. So in that context, I kind of look at incentives in two different categories. There is a tangible incentives and there's intangible incentives, right? The tangibles is, okay, well, am I getting properly paid? Am I getting rewarded, etc.? Intangible is, can I, and most of the stuff that we're talking about is driven by creative people and people who are driving innovation. There is a intangible factor of, am I as an individual flourishing to create what I want to create and contribute? And is my contribution meaningful to the purpose of the organization? And that's why many of the, you know, both whether it's NASA or DOD, I mean, most folks don't go and work there because of just a, you know, base earning. They go there because they want to live with a higher purpose. And many of us who work, who are not employed by them, but support them, do the same, you know, we do this same reason, right? It's a notion of contribution. So to track that contribution and to engage them, that's where the bottom up approach comes in. So imagine, you know, you have a portfolio and you have some task that says, okay, we're going to create a new, I don't know, a procurement system, which is now going to be enabled with AI and, you know, which was going to bring in the outside vendors part of the process, right? So in that case, you may have an engineer who may be in charge of the procurement system, that they may come up with an idea to maybe siphon through the proposal or the bids in a faster way, which actually helps the organization to choose the right solution and the vendors to do the work, right? So that engineer or that innovator not only wants to suggest their idea and be part of it, they want to be recognized for that, right? So in a couple of the military organizations that I have worked with, we did collectively created that kind of innovation funnel, and we recognized the people who were coming up with those ideas, because the idea will come into a funnel and then the team lead will decide which one of them to pursue. And then it will get all the way to a director level, which is, you know, in military context could be a colonel or a lieutenant colonel. Sometimes is a 2-star or 3-star general. So we all want to be recognized for that. So as a leader, you can't forget that intangible motivational factor for creation and innovation, right? And obviously you have to reward them financially and otherwise, you know, and upward career movement to do that. But encouraging engagement, inspiring, you know, I mean, one of my book called Lift, we talked about the 4 I of leadership, and influence and inspiration was kind of the two main factor to get stuff out of these people and let them be this in the same kind of a role where they can inspire and influence other people with their work. That's probably the biggest motivational factor I've seen in terms of innovation, driving innovation in a especially in large organization.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such an important point, and thank you for sharing that. In listening to you, I'm just thinking, you know, how much more of the team that you're inviting to really the table, right? They have a job to do. Yes, check the box. They, you know, they're there, they're doing exceptional work, right? They're getting the job done. But to the extent that you open up that other avenue for them to bring their ideas, their interests, right, their observations into the organizational game, if you will, right, putting those pieces on the table and then letting them be a part of what emerges after that and recognizing them for that, that allows them to bring so much more of themselves and their interests to the organization. That unlocks more, I think, passion and loyalty. We saw that at GE many times.
Yes. Yeah.
Funny story at GE when we did a lot of experiments along these lines, as well as you know.
Yeah.
And one of the experiments that we ran was an initiative to encourage the employees to bring their ideas for a new business. And we were looking for ultimately two business endeavors, one that could be a new business line for GE.
Yeah.
And one that could be a new business line outside of GE. Non-competitive, of course, but that our teams were seeing that the market needed that wasn't yet served. So we opened up, like you said, an ideation initiative. We were working with a partner to kind of host this ideation. And Beth Comstock was the champion of the initiative.
Yes.
She provided a little video to kind of kick it off. In the Monday morning that we kicked it off, released the video and opened up the platform, the vendor platform for the ideas. We took that vendor's server down. There were so many employees that were plugged in, that were engaged, and that were excited about it. It was just such a brilliant success. And it was really, for our leadership team, I think, a really compelling signal that the employees had so much more to bring to the conversation. And so it was incredibly gratifying. Ultimately, we were able to launch a new initiative internally, a new business line internally, and provide a sabbatical for an employee to take their idea for an external business launch.
Yeah, no, I was the reason I was recruited. I was recruited in one of those outside facing, you know, it was spin-off. It was a spin-off for public sector at that time that would bring the GE's buying power and provide it to the public sector organization. So, and we enabled that with the newly found internet technology and the browser-based interfaces, right? So, yeah, I remember those very well. Yes, great example. And, you know, and the challenge is, you know, this is, so So how do you, you know, we talk about system thinking and we talk about ecosystem driven approach. So it's actually making it repeatable and systemic, which is really very much boils down to establishing the right process, policy and systems, you know, that allows you to do that. Otherwise, the voices gets lost, right? So it's the equal voice, the giving equality to the voice and ideas in an unbiased way requires that systemic thinking and the enablement of those systems that allows you to, for the leaders to see these things.
Exactly right. Exactly right. We got to the point where we were just referring to it as, you know, making sure we had kind of a level playing field for the voice and the choice.
Yeah.
And that takes a fair amount of design and intention, right? To your point.
Yeah.
And really a shared vision for what that looks like, because it can quickly incite chaos, right? You can have a lot of kind of well-intended initiatives running in a lot of different directions. But when you design it, execute it well, it is just magic, right?
Yeah.
It outperforms dramatically traditional over-constrained operating models.
100%.
I'd love to kind of turn that same lens, just knowing your background and expertise, to the challenges that presents for some of our public sector friends. You and I both work with public sector organizations, and for many of them, that means working with international partners. It means working with levels of clearance. How does that translate into maybe a DoD setting? What kind of frameworks help these organizations that are very structured, very regimented, very protocol oriented, as you know, what frameworks can help them shift, transform, evolve their cultures, factoring in clearance levels, missions, and kind of international protocols? How do we help them make that journey?
Yeah, look, it takes deliberate and conscious effort, but yet it's kind of paradoxical because you're asking people to be open, but you're also asking people to be very guarded. A lot of these things actually got into when we were writing Transcend, you know, we came up with this dual framework called open and care, meaning that be open to possibility, but be careful and care enough so that you don't make things worse. So in that context, you know, what works is that I'll go back to that portfolio structure and deciding how you're allocating resources when you're executing ideas and where does those resource allocation goes and what kind of firewall do you need to put against those resources. So obviously when you're talking about DoD or you're talking about NASA or DHS, which has national security implications, you can't really outsource the domain expertise and the data element of it. But you can certainly take commercial technology or commercial vendors. You know, it's not just foreign. I mean, even on when you're talking about vendors that are, you know, all vendors and all personnel in the vendors doesn't have access to everything and anything. So taking those core commercialized technology, knowledge, expertise, whatever you want to call it, and then bringing it into a secure environment with the domain expertise that each of those organizations is how it's traditionally done. And what it requires a intentional, very, system-driven collaboration where you guardrail, you know, you have to have a proper governance structure, right? And what I've seen is that, and this could get very complex or it could be very, very, you know, very easily done in the sense that you have to have a human relationship and respect what's proper and what's not proper above and beyond just the traditional, you know, the governance framework and the guardrail that you have. But I mean, it's a simple example, right? I mean, if you want to have a web application or a cloud-based application, obviously DoD is not putting it in a commercial cloud. It's going in a Gov cloud or federal cloud or some other IL6 or IL5 type of environment. But the technology is still provided by a commercial entity. So the technology, base technology and base capabilities can be developed, but the adaptation of that happens behind a guardrail. This is where the governance structure becomes a critical factor, and how you do resource allocation when you're racking and stacking resource allocation, and you're kind of looking at the enterprise and the program and project risk becomes critical, right? Because, you know, there's a whole host of risk factor that you have to consider, and you rack and stack the viability of a program and a project very differently than you would do in a commercial sector, right? So commercial sector in many ways is less, you know, less risky than the agencies that we're talking about.
Yeah, no, great points. And listening to you as well, I'm thinking about how important a kind of a foundation of trust plays into ecosystemic operations, right? And that seems to be a little bit easier to achieve. You tell me if you disagree in commercial types of applications, but how do you get that same foundation of trust and fidelity built into a more interoperable, maybe ecosystem for forum with government applications? And that reach extends into industry, as you know, as you and I know. So how does that trust flow in government sectors of ecosystems?
I think that, you know, in government sector is different than commercial sector, because, you know, in commercial sector, your purpose is revenue driven, right? And your purpose is the stakeholders' value creation, right? That's kind of the purpose. When a commercial entity goes and works with a government agency, right? I would say that, you know, and if you look at most of the defense contractor, their ethos and the way they work and their value system, even though they're part of commercial organization, is different, because they kind of follow the same kind of higher level of ethos, in the sense that I'm here to serve the country first and at an agency and then my company, versus I'm serving my company. Of course, it's a capitalistic system and we thrive on that, and that's what drives the innovation. But so the trust factor, and you'll see repeatedly many of the people who goes and works for government are actual ex-government people who went back to commercial industry, learned few things, and bringing back that in the government agencies, right? So I think, I don't think government agencies always gets the credit, but the people, some of the people in government agencies and some of the people who comes from the commercial industry who tries to add value to the government agencies are probably the most smartest, ethical, and trustworthy people. And obviously most of them has clearances, right? So in that context, it's different. You know, it's not like when I do a startup, you know, and I'm trying to motivate the team to build a startup, it's a very different motivation and influence versus when I'm working with my cohorts at CSEI or DOD or DHS, because you're here for the country first. I think that's what motivates myself and some of the other people that I work with, right? It's different. So the trust factor, going back to the original question you asked me, how do you build that trust? It starts with that fundamental value system, that country first, and then everything else kind of follows, right? So it's not just your personal gain. So I cherish that, you know, often enough, I get asked, like, are you optimistic? I said, optimistic about what? Are you optimistic about the country? I said, I'm always optimistic about the country, because our country, because you have to look at the people, forget whatever out there, but you have to look at the people that does stuff day in, day out. Most of them are motivated by the betterment of the country.
That's exactly right. You see that so much when working, you know, with and around the government agencies. There are so many folks that are passionate about, they're patriots. They're passionate about our nation, right? And American excellence, right? Yep. Exceptionalism. It is a passion that drives many of us. And yeah, it's that shared kind of goal. And I do see that strengthening too. There is an intensification of focus that we're seeing. And it's also showing up in the areas that are in which we are investing, right, as a nation. And that helps to shape this sense of purpose in the ecosystems around those missions, right? So it's really exciting to see how that is evolving and emerging. And maybe if we look back, I'd love to look back a little bit in your experience. You have such a great vantage point in this evolution, right, of industries and models. And for those in your experience and observation, you've seen a lot of successful transitions, right, and evolution of models, right? But you've also seen some that maybe haven't worked as well. So in that kind of strategic arc of transformation and transition, what patterns have emerged in your observation? Those that maybe contributed to unsuccessful transitions and those that contributed to successful?
Yeah, look, first thing I would say, and you know this from your GE days as well, that personality driven transformation is short-lived, because it's when you are trying to drive transformation with personality, it when the person is gone, it's things dies out, right? So that's point number one. Point number two is that you have to take a balanced approach. You have to be very open to all sorts of possibilities and ideas, but you also have to do that with a proper governance model, right? That's the second part of it. Third part of it is that policy doesn't get executed without process and systems. So you have to embed the process and systems. You have to embed the policies with process and system. And it's not just a leadership trait. It has to be systemic, right? And the fourth is that because we are having this generational shift in workforce, and we are having a major technological shift in the workforce, the way we work, way we collaborate, the way we even allocate work, whether that's a human being and digital entity, that creates a different level of challenge in terms of not just crafting a purpose, but how does the purpose get aligned and executed, right? So, and you cannot really execute anymore just thinking about one thing, right? So a lot of people, they say, well, we just have, we cannot adhere to command control leadership, right? So, well, that is true, but command control kind of gets executed in the policy, procedure, and system, because it's like a navigating a large ship versus a speedboat. If I'm driving a speedboat or I'm driving my Ferrari, that's one thing. But if I'm driving a bus or I'm taking a cruise ship, it's very different, right? So the agencies that we're talking about and that is also true in Fortune 500, they're like those ships, big ships. So it takes system, policy, procedure, which you may say, well, that's too limiting, but without that guardrail, it falls apart and it never gets, you don't know who's doing what and how it connects the dot and all that. Every person got to know what their value is and how their value is tying to the purpose by following a systemic way of doing it, right? And in that context where that you create that ecosystem. And that's also how you prevent, that you brought up, we just talked about this. Well, there's foreign collaborator, there's vendors, and there's risk associated with working with all those folks. Well, how do you avoid that? Well, you avoid that by creating those systems and processes and policy procedure. So a policy, you may write a great policy document, but the policy document means nothing if you haven't executed that by rolling it out in people and the process and the way they're doing things.
Yeah, so right. And I'd love to maybe double click into that a little bit more. we spent a lot of time in this series with our guests talking about how, you know, the ecosystem models really apply equally to the health and resilience of organizations, but also of kind of macroeconomic conditions, right? And a national model in contrast to an organizational model. And I think kind of pulling those levers that you just described is a little bit easier within the confines of an organization. But if you look at the macroeconomic level, right, and take the US space economy as a really great example that you and I both know quite well and love, the space economy is just a fascinating study, right? It's really, space has been a domain for a long time, but for very limited circles. Now it's opening up, right? And we're seeing industry begin to embrace this, the opportunity and the vision. And we're seeing that across geographic and geopolitical boundaries. But as is so often the case, you see innovation as a first wave, adoption often as a second wave, and so often and sadly, regulation as the third and lagging wave, right? And we're seeing a chasm increase across, right, those three waves in different kind of different pacing for different kind of case studies. But if we take the space economy, highly regulated domain, incredibly dynamic and emergent, if you will, how does the research team and wave and the innovation wave bring the policy makers along with them so they have tighter alignment and vision and policies can be designed with more kind of beneficial kind of impacts rather than a kind of reactionary and maybe introducing unintended consequences? How do we get a policy landscape that drives the right experiences and outcomes for the space economy to emerge and flourish?
Yeah, look, I mean, it is always the case that policy and legislation kind of lags behind technology, right? And we kind of seen that in various technological evolution, whether that's nuclear, whether that's the social media, whether that's internet. There's a lot of conversation around AI. In the process of writing AI, I did spend a bit time with a couple of bipartisan senators who are trying to come up with policy and procedures. And I didn't focus on the space economy, but, you know, more on the, you know, the AI and automation industry as a whole. And the chat, it's complex, right? Because you want to create a slew of technology that's readily accessible and it drives things forward. But innovation without responsibility has consequences, right? So we kind of seeing that in social media, right? I mean, it wasn't really regulated and we have all sorts of problem with social media, whether that's bullying, whether that's whatever. And we're also seeing that in AI, where people are getting very heavily dependent. And there's this recent case of suicidal behavior by talking to chatbots, nefarious characters using AI to do harm to the country. I mean, there's all kind of stuff that's going on, right? Yeah. So I think that, you know, this is where I also say, when I was talking about there's a generational shift, and I don't mean this any political way or supporting one viewpoint versus another viewpoint, but the policymakers are also has to be of this generation. I mean, this generation, I don't mean by age. They have to be highly educated in the context of what technological evolution that's happening and what human impact is going to have. And as a result, what social impact it's going to have. And then ultimately, what's economic impact it's going to have. So imagine that. So I may remember this conversation with Senator Blumenthal because I live in Connecticut, but also they jointly crafted with Josh Holloway a AI guardrail legislation, which is sitting there. It hasn't been approved. But I was asking, like, look, I mean, you can look at this in many different ways. There's the economic impact because what would you do with all these jobless people, how do you rescale them, right, at a national level, right? And we're already seeing that, right, because you're seeing these tech vendors are laying people off. You're seeing that in robotic industry. You're seeing that in AI industry. You're seeing that in a whole slew of industry, right? And then the second element of it is that, well, how do you protect the next generation of children in terms of their evolution of cognitive thinking and cognitive skills if you get heavily dependent on this technological evolution? And the third is that, how do we protect our country if all these nefarious bad characters have access to the same technology as anybody else? Because that's a serious concern. The minute you put your national security hat, you have to start thinking about that, right? So the policymakers has to be well educated on the technological evolution and consider that greater macro ecosystem that you're talking about, meaning the people, the economy, the security, and the global geopolitical connectivity and implication that we are part of, right? So it's complex. You know, I don't know what the right answer is. I don't think anybody knows what the right answer is. But all I can say is that we have to be very proactive in terms of learning, and we have to push our legislators to be very proactive, being with the technological evolution and supporting the innovation mindset and our ability to continuously to innovate while protecting the country, the people, the economy, and the globe in general.
So right. There are so many recent and very punctuated examples of that risk, but also, you know, the great potential. So, you know, we have to lean into that and just be mindful of the risk that it represents, but find a path forward to better goodness. And that's really what we are trying to build a community around with Ecosystemic Futures, right? How do we understand the many kind of emergent technologies, phenomenons, models in this very dynamic landscape, all the intersections, and together kind of find a path forward where we're pruning some of the more harmful pathways and trying to really lean into some of the more beneficial pathways.
Right. Yeah, and Diane, I mean, there's a, you know, because of my the affinity with the philosophy, and particularly Eastern philosophy, I mean, you can boil it down to a very simple thing. None of us live in isolation, and if you look at a drop of water and you drop it in a bucket of water, it has a ripple effect, right? So we can't forget about the ripple effect. So this is where the responsibility comes in. Whatever drop we're creating, we have the responsibility where we are dropping that drop and what ripple effect is going to create in that, you know, in that total ecosystem that as you so eloquently crafting here, right? So it's important to think about that. And again, it's beyond just talking. You have to create that policy turning into process and system so that everybody follows the same rule and as a result can create a positive value and impact.
So right. Yeah, similar kind of a similar mindset, right? So our organization ShoshimWorks, and of course meaning the beginner's mind, Very intentional to kind of signal the need to, in many cases, kind of unlearn some of the assumptions and protocols that helped you successfully get to where you are, but may be constraints or introduce blinders for the path forward, right? We have to constantly relearn and reorient and revector in this dynamic landscape. And that has to be a very intentional strategy, to your point. You also, in your Convergence podcast, you just really brilliantly explore a lot of intersections of different domains. And so you similarly are leaning into the future, right? Very kind of futures oriented. If we consider maybe if we just once again take the convergence of commercial space, international cooperation, military space operations, deep space exploration, what kind of patterns do you anticipate in the evolving space economy? And maybe just even more broadly, just based on your conversation and your exploration of these intersections, what do you anticipate the next several decades might hold for others and for industry?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think the biggest driver of all this is, which is undeniable now, is AI, right? Because it's changing the way we think, work, play, govern, collect data, however you want to look at it. And never in human history we have created or we have managed to create. We've been at it for a long time. If you look at Transcend, I mean, we talk about the history of AI. It started in, you know, like several thousand years ago, because human being always wanted some sort of a device or things that are assisting human beings to be better. And at some point we said, well, can we create that can mimic human, you know, the human intelligence? And hence we are at the artificial intelligence era, right? So that has a monumental impact, and we are really, you know, many of us question, like, what is humanity to begin with? How do we protect humanity? And if we have things that are smarter than us, what happens to us? And if they can do all the work, then what happens to the human workers, right? And what do you do as a leader? You know, and then what do you teach our children? I mean, they're all going to become vegetable in the sense that they're so dependent on all these things that they're not really pushing themselves to learn a new thing or explore the things that naturally comes out of trial and error, right? So that sort of a thing. So what happens to innovation? So in Transcend, we explore, half of Transcend is about philosophy, the philosophical tenet of one, and that kind of now gotten into this podcast series that we started, where we explore the intersection of humanity, business, and technology, because, you know, it's a fundamental human question: what does it mean to be human, and how does it impact, you know, us in general, and then where does, and but the business, which is really the economy, drives all this, and then also obviously technology supports that economy. So the intersection, doesn't matter which industry you look at, it is going to grapple with these challenges and the big questions. And as a leader, you'll have to answer those, and you have to deal with it, right? So I think this is the question, quintessential question, that everybody's asking: what will happen to us in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and 30 years? Are we obsoleting ourselves? And what does that mean, right? And what does that mean to economy? What does that mean to the opportunities at the same time, in the sense that, you know, if you do space exploration, or one of my big thing has become is healthcare, because I have a cancer surviving son. And so I'm constantly looking at that space. How do you do faster drug discovery? How do you do better data collection so that you can do custom treatment for diseases like cancer and other things? Those are all the opportunities, right? So it's a broad-based philosophical conversation: what happens to humanity in the context of this new innovation and new technologies that we're exploring, and what's responsible and what's irresponsible, and what is the role of government, and what's the role of private citizen, and what's the role of organization as a whole, right? And those are the bigger questions.
So right. We've been working with our partners in government and industry, but more importantly, government. To your point, I do believe that we're seeing an evolution of the role of government, a necessary evolution, right? This is just such an interesting time, and it's a great opportunity for them to kind of stretch their relationships into academia and industry and with international partners, leveraging the ecosystem model and some of these technologies that make it easier to extend the reach of high value information, high value connections, collaborations. There is just this infrastructure, this foundation of information, of incentive, and we're able to, I think, help each other a little bit more and create more resilient and federated operations, to your point. And with that, we'll need to probably wrap things up from here, but I'd love to just put a bow on so many of these important lessons for our listeners, for those that are out there trying to navigate this shift, whether they're in government or in commercial organization. Your your recommendations for how they begin that journey from traditional operating models to more ecosystemic operating models, just very kind of actionable, navigable first steps to begin that journey for our listeners?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's, I start with a very fundamental question is why? Why are you doing what you're doing, right? So, mm-hmm. and it's a very, it ties to purpose. What's your purpose? Right? Why do you want to do this, right? Whatever it is, whether that's a build a new spaceship, build a new a robotic factory, or come up with a new large, a next generation large language model, whatever the case may be, why do you want to do this? What impact, what's the purpose, and what human impact do you want to create out of this, right? Is it really going to help somebody? Helping somebody is different than, am I going to make a bunch of money if I build something, right? So it's a different, so you have to really ask yourself what impact you are moving towards with your why. And then comes the how. And the how comes, this is where the ecosystem plays a definitive role, because how, the question, the how allows you to say, okay, well, I need to get a expert in ethics. I need to get an expert in research. I need to get an expert in, you know, systemic process creation or portfolio management, whatever the case may be. This is where the ecosystem comes in play, right? So focus on your why, figure out what impact, I mean, you know, you're going to create, and then tie into your how by leveraging your ecosystem. And, you know, as you know, I love frameworks. So repeatedly, anything I write or do, try to give it like a some level of, you know how or how to that people can follow. So whether that's in Reinvent or Lyft or Transcend or any of the articles that I write, you know, you're talking about ecosystem, that the most recent article that we written for Fast Company around ecosystem had that tentacles of how do you bring the academia and government and commercial world together to create that ecosystem in a meaningful way.
Yeah. So glad that you and your team are leading this work. And I would very strongly recommend for our listeners out there, if you haven't already, please do make sure that you visit Faisal's work and at faisalhoch.com and definitely check out these books. Amazing, amazing resources. And are there other sources, Faisal, that are?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I write we write regular columns on Fast Company, Psychology Today, IMD, yep. Our Business Review, MIT Sloan. There's plenty, and I post something every day on LinkedIn. A little bit of a micro knowledge sharing that ties to some bigger learning, but you can access to it. And by the way, all the books are for charity. All the proceeds goes to cancer research. So it's very personal to me. So if you buy the book, not only you're going to learn something, maybe you'll help a children who's fighting with cancer.
So important. So much goodness there. Thank you so much, Faisal. I really enjoyed our conversation today and look forward to keeping in touch. And for our listeners, just hang out in Faisal's digital exhaust. You'll inevitably learn something. Buy the books. You're going to learn something. You're also going to do great good. So stay in Faisal's ecosystem and goodness will follow for sure. And we would also, again, always, as always, folks, please do follow us and keep in touch with our episodes as we continue examining ecosystemic thinking and how it can transform our approach to industry, policy, and society and more beneficial paths forward. So follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and you can always follow us on shoshimworks.com. Thanks again, everyone.
Thanks for having me.